In coming here tonight to speak with you, I feel a little bit the way I'm sure Marco Polo must have felt when, home again at last, he began to tell about what he had seen. Of course, almost no one believed him. And those who did believe him, he must have known, attributed such fanciful images in their own mind to what he said about the places he had visited, that their own belief was really making a liar of him. Partly our trouble, I think, is that we look at the world through the eyes of our great-grandparents. We really are 19th century people. And our values are 19th century values, our beliefs are 19th century beliefs. We think that what was normal in the 19th century must be normal today. Nothing could be more untrue. The 19th century was probably one of the unique periods in human history. There are sometimes in human history when there is a certain amount of quiet and stability. But by far the greater part of human history has been great disorder, great instability, great change, movement everywhere. We are in one of those great periods of instability. But all our thoughts, all our traditions come from the 19th century. And therefore we look for normality in what is stable. We expect institutions to be developed which will bring about peace and quiet and orderly behavior. We knew that in the 19th century there was greater freedom of movement than there had ever been before in the history of the world. We know that in the 19th century there was greater economic development than there had been from the beginning of man up to that time. And generally, there was a greater absence of international war. And this seems normal, and we are now looking for conditions of that sort to be established. And I'm afraid that we are doomed to disappointment. This is a period of change. This is a period of revolution. We are moving either toward a new equilibrium, or we are not. If we look back over the time which separates us from the 19th century, we will see that during the 50 years of this century, we have destroyed the entire world order which existed before. That world order was grouped around six great empires of Europe: the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Italian Empire, the French Empire, the German, and the British. Now, every one of those has either completely disappeared or has been radically changed. Let us see what the world looks like after the world order of the 19th century has been destroyed with the destruction of these empires. We see emerging from the ruins of this old world two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. We see a certain grouping of other states around those powers. We see, again in the world, very large populations, very large areas of land, which are, in Chester Bowles' phrase, uncommitted, the uncommitted areas: South Asia, Africa, Southeast Asia, and perhaps Latin America. Now let's examine these three main factors here and see what happens. First of all, the Soviet Union. Here we have a large, powerful, capable people under the leadership of a dynamic group who have a particularly ruthless conception of leadership. Idea that this is something about communism, which is dynamic, is really quite foolish. Communism has been around for 100 years, more than 100 years. Nobody was ever made dynamic by it until the new leadership of the Russian state began going forward. And it isn't the communism which makes it dynamic. It is the conception of operating in the world which the Russian and the Chinese leaders now have. This, I think, is very well described by a most able book recently produced by the University of Pennsylvania Press called The Protracted Conflict. The basic conception of the leaders of the Soviet Union and of China is one of conflict, protracted conflict, always attack. As long as you are weaker physically, keep the attack in the non-physical area. Keep all the opponents busy. Keep them off balance. Never let up. Always attack. Always assert. Always be pushing forward. Along with this goes also the insistence upon one of the great rules of all sort of military operation, and that is deceit, surprise, the unexpected. Always deceive your opponent. Keep him off guard. Keep him expecting an attack from the right when he gets it from the left. Now, these elements are the elements of vigor, vitality, and aggression which are present in these two powerful states, the Russian one being much more powerful than the Chinese, but working more or less together. One will see that the Russian Soviet state has accomplished the most extraordinary miracles in a very short time. It is a little more than 40 years since the Bolshevik Revolution. Of those 40 years, 20 years have been taken up, first of all, in establishing the regime, then in World War II and recovery from it. So in 20 years, the Soviet state has built up a productive power and a production which is only it's just about one half of that of the United States. And it is a little less than all of Western Europe together. Now, let us look at our own friends. As I said a little while ago, there is not enough power in Europe to equal the capability of the Soviet state. This does not have to be, but it is true. There are as many people, more people in Europe than there are in Western Europe, than there are in the Soviet Union. There is a greater production in Western Europe than there is in the Soviet Union. But these countries are torn by the war. They're split socially and politically inside, and there is not that dynamic drive to maintain a position which exists in the Soviet Union. Therefore, they look to the United States for leadership. And since the war, we have had over and over again to build up these countries, first of all by emergency aid, then by saving the eastern end of the Mediterranean, then by the Marshall Plan, then by NATO. We have had to pull these countries together so that their strength added to our strength counterbalanced the power and the capability of the Soviet Union. And this has been American policy pretty much since the end of the war. Therefore, it is the combination of the United States and of Western Europe, the common inheritors of the same civilization, which can bring together twice as many people as the Soviet Union has, twice as much production, and therefore should be able to bring some security in the world which has been left after the destruction of the old order. This has seemed to those who are working in this world the first order of necessity. First, you look around among the ruins and find those sources of strength which remain. Rebuild those to health. Bring them together in common political policies and common military policies and say, here is something which can prevent the hegemony of the Soviet Union. And under the shield of this combination, we can go forward to restore some stable life. Then one looks at the rest of the world, and one sees throughout South Asia, Africa, and South America, peoples who have been through violent change in their own life. They have thrown off, in almost all cases, the rule of some foreign state, whether it's British or French or Belgian or whatever it may be. They have come to independence. In some way or other, they have thought that this automatically should change their life in the economic and social fields, and it has not done that. This leads them to frustration and disappointment. In some way, they still believe that they're being exploited by someone else. In the present world, there is knowledge everywhere of conditions everywhere else. In the old days, no one in North Africa knew what was going on in the British Isles. No one in Shanghai had any idea what it was like in San Francisco. But now they know instantly. Pictures, radio, television, this is carried to all parts of the world. And people in these undeveloped areas know that their life is different from life in other places. They know that it's shorter. They know it's more painful. They know that it has less promise and capacity for living. And they don't like this, and they want it changed. And they bring pressure on their governments to change it. And no governments are going to survive who do not do something in this area. Now, this produces a very grave problem. It produces a very grave problem because merely wanting something doesn't produce it. And many of these people believe that it should. On the other hand, it is rather confusing for many people in the West. We are inclined to believe that there is a mystique about our industrial civilization. This is something that only white people who have laboriously gone through the Industrial Revolution can achieve. This is not true at all. This can be achieved very quickly by people who have the basic requirements of education and some kind of discipline and order. It cannot be done if there is complete disorder in the country. It cannot be done if nobody can read and write. It cannot be done if no one knows which end of a screwdriver you use to work with. But these things can be learned quickly. And therefore, in this development, you have to begin at the beginning. You have to begin the way people began in this country. You begin with schools. Long before we had factories in the United States, we had schools. And people went to school before they went to a factory. And this is what you have to do in these other parts of the world. And this is what the other parts of the world really don't understand. They want a steel mill right away. There are countries in South America, the northern part of South America, which are quite rich and can afford to do what they should do. But what they think they should do is to build Hilton hotels in every city, have a steel mill which no one knows how to operate, and bankrupt their governments. In one country that I know about, there are 400,000 children that have no school to go to, and there are 50,000 a year being added to that. Now, this is the social overhead which has to be invested before you can have industrialization. And this is a problem. And we have all wrestled with this problem, and we have not been too successful with it. However, this is one of the essential jobs to be done in creating the new world order that I'm talking about. First of all, you have to do, as I have said, restore the center of power. And that center of power is Western Europe and North America. And it's the center of power because these people, for a long, long time, have been producing. These people can understand the ideas that we're talking about. Other peoples will take a good many decades to catch up. So that the center of power at the present time is Western Europe and North America. These two places must see to it, these two areas and these two groups of peoples, that the whole non-communist world has in it the opportunity for underdeveloped countries to develop very quickly in their own way without being bossed around by other people. Helped, yes. Perhaps not given too much, perhaps made to understand that the rule of this world is that you have to work for what you get. Now here, this is the task of order. Now what sort of political policies does this bring about? I think that you will begin to see what I will think are the proper policies. First of all, in the political field, it means that Western Europe and North America must be brought as close together as they possibly can be, that their coalition must contemplate common policies. It must contemplate also a common defense, and that nothing must be allowed to interfere with that. Now this is primary. This is absolutely essential. If this is not done, it makes no difference how much you want to help the undeveloped areas. There will be no opposing Soviet power. There will be no counterweight to Soviet power. And the whole world will gradually fall under the domination of the dominating power. Therefore, North America and Western Europe is the central coalition. And they must understand one another, and they must subordinate their national ambitions and troubles and worries to the common interest. Now, we are not always doing that. Sometimes we fail, sometimes one of our allies fails. But that doesn't make it any less true. It also means that one must subordinate policies which are inconsistent with this policy. And so often we find ourselves unable to do that in the United States. We like all sorts of ideas, even though they are completely inconsistent with one another. Now, this seems to be sort of a happy American characteristic. They can all go together. Well, they can't go together. And therefore, to harp on a matter which I have been speaking just a few days ago, one cannot say that Western Europe and North America must remain absolutely united politically and militarily, and yet that we will move out of the center of Europe, that Germany will be neutralized and disarmed, and that one of the central places necessary for the defense of the West now becomes abandoned by the West. This is just inconsistent. It won't work. I know that a lot of things are said to follow from disengagement. It is said that this will bring about the unification of Germany, that this will bring about all sorts of things in Eastern Europe. But the one thing that we know it'll bring about is that it will break up the unity of Western Europe and North America and make impossible that defensive system. Therefore, we must say, I'm very sorry, but some of these other things are desirable, but we can't have those now. I think we should say to the Russians, we look forward to the time, and we want you to know that we look forward to the time, when all government in Europe is going to have a basis in national acceptance. The satrapies which are now being run by your henchmen throughout Eastern Europe are someday going to come to an end. Now, this ought to be done with every respect for your Russian security interests. You're entitled to have them. You have been attacked twice in this century through these very countries, and you're entitled to have this security, and we will see that you get it. But you do not belong there, and your henchmen do not belong there. And this alien form of governmental control is not a European form and doesn't belong in Europe. So far, you may be thinking, this is a pretty bloodthirsty man who's talking to us tonight. And he's against negotiation, he's against all these things. And so now I'm going to show you that that isn't true. I should love to have been at Camp David with Mr. Khrushchev. That is, I should like to have been with him alone. What I should like to have said to Mr. Khrushchev is, sit down, don't be so eager to answer me back all the time. I don't want to have a debate now. I'm not trying to be smart with you, Mr. K. Put your feet up on the chair, take a good drink of vodka, and listen to me for a little while. And then I would say, if the development of India and China and of some parts of Africa goes as fast as the development of your own country has gone, quite a while before the year 2000, which is not very far away, they will be producing as much and as ably as you are. This is quite a sobering thought. And Mr. K, they will be producing right across the board, not merely shoes and toothbrushes and Fords, but they will be also producing atomic weapons. And this is really very confusing indeed. Because we notice in the economic growth of people that your Mr. Marx really made a deep mistake. Mr. Marx thinks everything is predetermined. In fact, it isn't. And there comes a point where a nation has gone through the various stages of economic development and comes to that stage where it is producing its own productive machinery. That is the stage of sustained growth. At that point, it has three choices, and nations have made any one of these three choices. One is to put back their new production into more machines so you produce still more. That's a perfectly good one to make for a time. If you do it forever, it isn't a very wise one. Some other nations have chosen the welfare state. At this point, produce consumers' goods. This is the kind of a choice that we'd like to see most nations make. The third choice, and this unhappily is the choice that Germany made twice, is to put this increased productive capacity into an attempt to conquer the world, to build the greatest armies in the world, the greatest weapons in the world, and have a shot at domination. Now, Mr. Khrushchev, I'd say there are an awful lot of people in China, and there are an awful lot of people in India, and if they ever got hold of their population problems so it didn't pursue them so fast, they couldn't do anything else. If they were able to handle that and were able to produce and got the idea of military domination, you and we alike would be in trouble. And so would the world be in trouble. But we have a little while here now when you and we, Mr. Khrushchev, could affect the whole future of the world. We could turn the world from this horror into a world which would really be pretty nice. Maybe not as nice as we would like it, because it seems to me there are going to be so many people that it'll be awfully hard to keep somebody else's elbow out of your own eye pretty soon. But aside from that problem, we could keep the world peaceful, producing, perhaps producing a little less after a while. Perhaps people might get the idea that it'd be fun to lie out in the sun or go fishing or take some more time off or read a book even, that rather startling thing. But at any rate, There is now about 10 years, perhaps, when the United States and the Soviet Union, if it could get into some agreement about armaments, could really affect the history of the world. And I would say, I don't mean one of your great ideas of total disarmament in 4 years. That really seems to me not only a little bit fantastic, but I'm not sure it's very wise. It just occurs to me that if you had total disarmament in 4 years and all you Russians took baseball bats and started marching east, west, there'd be trouble somewhere. Perhaps we don't want total disarmament. Perhaps the kind of disarmament we want is what I was saying the other day to the NATO parliamentarians. A disarmament which shortened the reach of these great powers. A disarmament which made us unable to go looping over the oceans and landing missiles in Russia, and they doing the same thing here. But leaving enough armament so that everybody was pretty nearly impregnable at home. So it was very, very hard to invade or attack or to threaten to do those things. This seems to me to reduce inspection problems to a practicable proportion. If you say we're going to abolish every kind of a nuclear missile of any sort, and you tell an inspector to go and enforce that, I don't know how he's going to do it. But if you say that there are going to be certain ones allowed, but not enough to cause this war, or cause this aggression, then it is possible to do that kind of inspection, because then you begin to know where the things are made. You can look at the books. It's much harder to catch a bootlegger than it is to find a distiller cheating. That just occurred to me at the moment. That's rather brilliant thought. This is the direction of my thought. And therefore, what I would think is possible is not to engage in the kind of negotiation where there is not mutuality. Mutuality means that each one has as much to gain out of a negotiation as the other. If you take Berlin, for instance, nobody can gain out of that except the Russians. They say, get out. We say, we can't do that. They say, let's negotiate. What do? Get half out? There isn't. This doesn't seem to me to be a negotiable question. But this other matter does. And it seems to be one, to me, which would benefit them, benefit us, and change the whole history of the world to all the peoples of the world in a great, beneficent way. And if that happened, then I think we would almost see the flowering of what I've been talking about this whole evening, which is the creation of a new world order, which is based on balance, the balance of the Western powers balancing the other powers. And out of that balance, out of that equilibrium, come institutions which make for growth and prosperity of people who are undeveloped, and for the peace of everybody. Thank you very much.